This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our country, fighting for our freedom, and we don't want to forget that. So the purpose of this show is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated. We're certainly entertained and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I hope that'll be the case today as you get a taste of the special spirit of a man who's gathering with family this weekend in Bakersfield, California to celebrate his 92nd birthday. Back on November 8th, 1922, he was born in the Ozarks. Jake Luttrell. Don't call him Luttrell, or you'll get it wrong. And when I walked up to the door, I saw a little sheep on a board. It said Luttrell Farms, but I don't smell the sheep around here. Where are you hiding them?
They're down in the basement. No, they were on the farm when my granddaughter, Lori, here was little, and her dad set her up with one or two sheep. No one is on the farm anymore, so it's just a sign.
Well, we're not putting you out to pasture either, so don't be worried. But I imagine you might have seen a sheep or a cow or some kind of livestock out in the Ozarks growing up. Tell me about your childhood back in Missouri.
Well, down in the Ozarks where all eight of the children in the family started, it was strictly farming, such as up in the flatlands of Missouri, but also cows and horses and chickens and the whole nine yards. And then in 1928, we moved up more or less mid-state, about 70 miles south of Kansas City, along the Missouri-Kansas line, and was there for a good long while. In fact, that's where I lived when the wife and I got married and come to California.
Well, there's a story there, too, that I want to hear. But before we get to that, you said eight children. Where were you on that list of eight?
As the last one.
You're the youngest of eight.
I'm the only one left.
You must have got beaten up a lot by all those older siblings.
Verbally, even as well as physically.
Do you remember, I know that's a long time ago, but do you remember what kind of ambitions you had? What you thought you might be doing with yourself?
Maybe not as much as I would be now, because times were so tough. We had our mind on working and doing something to cause us to be able to eat. Really, it was that simple. And yet I would say, for the most of us, it was wanting to go to school and do something besides digging the ground. But we just didn't all make it out. Turned out to be a blacksmith, and the others went to school.
You said it was hard, those depression days. How hard was it? How bad was it? Can you give us an example of the things, the sacrifices that you and your family had to make?
I can tell you a little story, strangely, that I remember today. My brother was closest one to me, about 3 years difference. And one day we made an agreement. We were going to check and see how much money was actually spent at the country store by our family, and there was he and I and mom and dad yet at home, and we kept close watch. And the first month it was I think $4.10, and the next month we was trying harder. I guess it was just a little less than $4 cash. That is, we'd trade in hens and a pig maybe for flour and sugar and things like that. But it couldn't have been much worse in a sense, and yet survived in good shape. I mean, we never went hungry, but money was non-existent. Just didn't have any.
Looking back now, what do you think that did for you and your perspective on life in general?
Well, I think it was probably some of the best education that we ever got in our lives, something that maybe some of the young people ought to get today. We never had any wishes for instance, a new car or anything like that, because it wasn't even in the book. And consequently, we fought it out until World War II made a big difference. After World War II was over, people kind of made a new start. There was jobs that wasn't there before. Every time we could take a step up, forward. We did. Whereas today, I've made my thoughts of being a funny. I said, well, the young people today want to start at the top and work their way up.
There's a lot of truth in that statement. You didn't have a choice. And did you start to develop some of your mechanical skills back home as a young boy? Were you tinkering and fixing things that young?
Very little, because of the fact that there was no tools. We had an old hammer, an old handsaw, and a few rusty nails, and that was about the size of it. My dad was a country farmer, preacher. Done a good job at what he done, but he wasn't a mechanic. Now, immediately following with the war, almost all young people had an opportunity to get into something that would cause them to be able to develop into a decent job, and then, like I say, it would just gradually improve as time went on. And I went on, well, after I got out here.
I got to get that story of how you came out here, though, because this is a pretty good story. What year was that?
1941.
But there's a little lead up to this here. So you've been seeing this girl for a while. You're what, 18 years old at the time, not quite 19?
About 18.
And you told your parents you were going to join the military. And what'd they say?
Well, of course, I married an older woman. She was a year older than me.
So first you said, I'm going into the service. And they said no, and then your comeback was, well, then I'm moving to California.
Well, it was the war, and stories you read indicated that there was changes, movement, and that was the other thought to come in my mind. If I couldn't get in the military, well, all of this was going on in California. That's where all the milk and honey was. Now, not that everything was all that much better at that time, but it developed quicker.
So you thought, let's go to California, and you mentioned that to your girlfriend, and she said what?
She said, well, I think we ought to get married first. Well, I don't know. I could say anything good about her. It wouldn't be questioned by these people here, my granddaughter and grandson. Not too many around. I can say they didn't make them like that anymore. She was, that's her right up there. She made life so much easier on a husband and wife team. We never had hers and mine, like bank accounts or anything like that. It was ours. Made it much, much easier.
But you had a real expensive and elaborate and costly wedding, right?
My father-in-law gave me a nickel, and who's to say if that was all just a joke or funny or what, but my mom and dad would have given me their left leg if I'd asked for it, but they didn't have a penny, and we didn't fuss about it, didn't have any problem whatsoever. We did go out and spend a night with them, believe it or not, before we took off for California, and just had a great time. And then on the way out in that 31 Model A, that was our fun trip as newlyweds. We had her mother and my mother and her little brother and the wife and I in that Model A Ford.
And were you exaggerating earlier when you told me that it was a $2 wedding? Was that really the price of the whole thing?
That was a fact. I gave the justice of peace $1, and then certificate was $1. Well, then later I had given her a ring. It was used, and it was something like $1.50. We didn't go broke by throwing money.
But lo and behold, it worked out all right, huh?
Yeah, it was strange. Some of the people that always would pick it, young people, said, well, we'll give them 30 days. Well, when Mom died, it was, what, 59 years? Would have been 73 years or so if she hadn't have passed away. It just goes to show you that sometimes the experts can be wrong.
So you come to California, and I think you started to say you ended up at the shipyards. Is that what you were doing before you ended up in the service?
Yeah. My first real job was down here at the old Padre Hotel, which is still in business. But when this job opening come up down south at Cal Shipbuilding, on the west side of Long Beach. Well, just no way in the world you could turn it down.
What kind of ships were you guys building?
Liberty ships.
And is that where you were when you found out the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor?
That was where I was at when Franklin Roosevelt located me and sent me an invitation. Come see us.
Yeah, I've heard about those invitations. Well, what do you remember about December 7th? Because everybody that I've talked to seems to remember something about that day and how they found out.
I was working down in Los Angeles at a fruit farm that is the warehouse in town from the fruit farm. It come on the radio, of course, and spliced all over that the Japanese had struck Pearl Harbor. And we didn't have, of course, the facilities that you do today, but the foreman had an old 50-foot drop cord, and he rigged up and plugged it in, and he had a little radio, just, oh, gee, you could put it in your pocket nearly. He plugged that in, and he let everybody quit, gathered around that table for, oh, 2 hours or longer. We listened to the comments, news, and so forth. But it was hard to understand the size of it. All of us were young. It was hard to understand why people would want to butcher and kill, but then later it become a little easier to understand when you've seen it.
Yeah, you would see plenty, not against the Japanese, but against the enemy in Europe. And you mentioned getting that invitation from the president, Uncle Sam, saying, we want you. So you're working in the shipyard at the time. That's obviously related to the war effort, but they drafted you. What'd you think about that? How'd you feel about that?
Well, frankly, I was a little upset because the wife was carrying our first son, and I went to the draft board. It was an older man and two older women, and I said, I'm sorry, you can't have me right now. I said, told them situation. Oh, well, that doesn't make any difference. You're just exactly what we need. You've got the experience. And I said, no, I can't go off and leave them. I reached up and got a pen and a piece of paper, and I wrote down there Amsterdam, Missouri, or Butler. I went home and told Mom, and she got the fruit jar where she'd been collecting our money. And we had a 37 Ford coupe. I've got pictures of it. We got in that dude and headed for Missouri. Well, when I got there, they were already there. Waiting on me.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there listening right now who understand why you would have done anything to be there for your pregnant wife. But now you're drafted, you end up in the Army Air Corps. I know they had you train in Florida for a bit, but then you got to go to St. Louis for aircraft welding school. What kind of things did you learn over there?
Well, first of all, I learned a lot about dealing with each other, people on people. And then, of course, in this aircraft welding, was great.
How to repair an airplane that had been damaged and weld pieces back together kind of thing?
Well, and doing any kind of, at that time, light welding, because in the aircraft welding was pretty much all light instead of, like, if you've been in a shipyard, why, it's heavy welding.
And I know you had some more training in Salt Lake City, but then your final training was something called Overseas Fitness, which concluded in a pretty unique way.
Our last training on that was going across country in a train of boxcars, cattle cars, with about 95 prisoners, and then my buddy and I. That was an experience.
These are German prisoners?
Ours. They were promised free and out of, and they were actually in jail. I mean, actually prisoners. If they would volunteer to go overseas because they felt like they needed more people than what they were getting by drafting. But it didn't work. They went haywire before we got to Chicago, and they had to call out the state militia and take over.
So you were on a train that the state militia had to take over?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure a lot of folks are like me, and they've never heard about that before. Convicts getting the chance at amnesty in exchange for going overseas to fight in World War II. And you mentioned going overseas. We should mention your son was about 3 weeks old when you shipped out. Did you get a chance to get home and see your wife and that firstborn child before you headed overseas?
Yes, they sent me home in an old C-47, cold as blazes. Of course, that thing didn't have like airplanes today. It wasn't insulated. It was just skin. And I was wrapped up in blankets and laying on the floor, and I got to Kansas City. I made it. It was worth it to get to come home and see the baby and see the my wife. But then never seen him again until the war was over. You didn't really have the time to think about how bad it was, like you would maybe at a different time, although it was tough. But there was just so much to do and deal with.
Well, and I want to talk about some of those things you were busy doing, but right now we need to take our first commercial break. If you want to see pictures of our birthday boy, Jake Luttrell, then and now, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Radio Facebook page. When we come back, we'll hear about an invention this welding aficionado's ingenuity produced in Europe during World War II. and why it's a bit of a bittersweet memory for him today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.